Side 7, The City and the Stars and the Sands of Mars by Arthur C. Clarke, continuing with The City and the Stars, on page 253. Geraint thinks he can get some of us to come to Lys, and I am willing to help him with the experiment, even though half the time I hope that it will fail. Alvin looked at his old tutor with a new respect. He no longer discounted the power of suggestion, nor underestimated the forces which would compel a man to act in defiance of logic. He could not help comparing Jezerak's calm courage with Kedron's panic flight into the future, though with his new understanding of human nature, he no longer cared to condemn the jester for what he had done. Geraint, he was certain, would accomplish what he had set out to do. Jezerak might be too old to break the pattern of a lifetime, however willing he might be to start afresh. That did not matter, for others would succeed with the skilled guidance of the psychologists of Lys. And once a few had escaped from their billion-year-old mould, it would only be a question of time before the remainder could follow. He wondered what would happen to Diaspora and to Lys when the barriers were fully down. Somehow the best elements of both must be saved and welded into a new and healthier culture. It was a terrifying task, and would need all the wisdom and all the patience that each could bring to bear. Some of the difficulties of the forthcoming adjustments had already been encountered. The visitors from Lys had, politely enough, refused to live in the homes provided for them in the city. They had set up their own temporary accommodation in the park, among surroundings which reminded them of Lys. Hilvar was the only exception. Though he disliked living in a house with indeterminate walls and ephemeral furniture, he bravely accepted Alvin's hospitality, reassured by the promise that they would not stay here for long. Hilvar had never felt lonely in his life, but he knew loneliness in Diaspora. The city was stranger to him than Lys had been to Alvin, and he was oppressed and overwhelmed by its infinite complexity, and by the myriads of strangers who seemed to crowd every inch of space around him. He knew, if only in a tenuous manner, everyone in Lys, whether he had met them or not. In a thousand lifetimes he could never know everyone in Diaspora. And though he realized that this was an irrational feeling, it left him vaguely depressed. Only his loyalty to Alvin held him here in a world that had nothing in common with his own. He had often tried to analyze his feelings toward Alvin. His friendship sprang, he knew, from the same source that inspired his sympathy for all small and struggling creatures. This would have astonished those who thought of Alvin as willful, stubborn, and self-centered, needing no affection from anyone and incapable of returning it even if it was offered. Hilvar knew better than this. He had sensed it instinctively even from the first. Alvin was an explorer, and all explorers are seeking something they have lost. It is seldom that they find it, and more seldom still that the attainment brings them greater happiness than the quest. What Alvin was seeking, Hilvar did not know. He was driven by forces that had been set in motion ages before by the men of genius who planned Diaspora with such perverse skill, or by the men of even greater genius who had opposed them. Like every human being, Alvin was in some measure a machine, his actions predetermined by his inheritance. That did not alter his need for understanding and sympathy, nor did it render him immune to loneliness or frustration. To his own people, he was so unaccountable a creature that they sometimes forgot that he still shared their emotions. It needed a stranger from a totally different environment to see him as another human being. Within a few days of arriving in Diaspora, Hilvar had met more people than in his entire life, met them, and had grown to know practically none. Because they were so crowded together, the inhabitants of the city maintained a reserve that was hard to penetrate. The only privacy they knew was that of the mind, and they still clung to this, even as they made their way through the endless social activities of Diaspora. Hilvar felt sorry for them, though he knew that they felt no need for his sympathy. They did not realize what they were missing. They could not understand the warm sense of community, the feeling of belonging, which linked everyone together in the telepathic society of Lys. Indeed, though they were polite enough to try to conceal it, it was obvious that most of the people he spoke to looked upon him pityingly as leading an incredibly dull and drab existence. Ariston and Titania, Alvin's guardians, Hilvar quickly dismissed as kindly but totally baffled non-entities. He found it very confusing to hear Alvin refer to them as his father and mother, words which in this still retained their ancient biological meaning. It required a continual effort of imagination to remember that the laws of life and death had been repealed by the makers of Diaspora, and there were times when it seemed to Hilvar that despite all the activity around him, the city was half empty because it had no children. He wondered what would happen to Diaspora now that its long isolation was over. The best thing the city could do, he decided, was to destroy the memory banks which had held it entranced for so many ages. Miraculous though they were, perhaps the supreme triumph of the science that had produced them, they were the creations of a sick culture, a culture that had been afraid of many things. Some of those fears had been based on reality, but others, it now seemed, lay only in the imagination. Hilvar knew a little of the pattern that was beginning to emerge from the exploration of Vanimon's mind. In a few days, Diaspora would know it too, and would discover how much of its past had been a myth. Yet if the memory banks were destroyed, within 1,000 years the city would be dead, since its people had lost the power to reproduce themselves. That was the dilemma that had to be faced, but already Hilvar had glimpsed one possible solution. There was always an answer to any technical problem, and his people were masters of the biological sciences. What had been done could be undone, if Diaspora so wished. First, however, the city would have to learn what it had lost. Its education would take many years, perhaps many centuries. But it was beginning. Very soon the impact of the first lesson would shake Diaspora as profoundly as had contact with Lys itself. It would shake Lys, too. For all the difference between the two cultures, they had sprung from the same roots, and they had shared the same illusions. They would both be healthier when they looked once more with a calm and steadfast gaze into the past which they had lost. Chapter 24. The amphitheatre had been designed to hold the entire waking population of Diaspora, and scarcely one of its 10 million places was empty. As he looked down the great curving sweep from his vantage point high up the slope, Alvin was irresistibly reminded of Shalmarain. The two craters were of the same shape and almost the same size. If one packed the crater of Shalmarain with humanity, it would look very much like this. There was, however, one fundamental difference between the two. The great bowl of Shalmarain existed. This amphitheatre did not. Nor had it ever done so. It was merely a phantom, a pattern of electronic charges, slumbering in the memory of the central computer until the need came to call it forth. Alvin knew that in reality he was still in his room, and that all the myriads of people who appeared to surround him were equally in their own homes. As long as he made no attempt to move from this spot, the illusion was perfect. He could believe that Diaspora had been abolished, and that all its citizens had been assembled here in this enormous concavity. Not once in 1,000 years did the life of the city stop so that all its people could meet in grand assembly. In this also, Alvin knew, the equivalent of this gathering was taking place. There it would be a meeting of minds, but perhaps associated with it would be an apparent meeting of bodies, as imaginary yet as seemingly real as this. He could recognize most of the faces around him, out to the limits of unaided vision. More than a mile away, and 1,000 feet below, was the little circular stage upon which the attention of the entire world was now fixed. It was hard to believe that he could see anything from such a distance, but Alvin knew that when the address began, he would hear and observe everything that happened as clearly as anyone else in Diaspora. The stage filled with mist. The mist became Calitrax, leader of the group whose task it had been to reconstruct the past from the information which Vanimond had brought to Earth. It had been a stupendous, almost an impossible undertaking, and not merely because of the spans of time involved. Only once, with the mental help of Hilvar, had Alvin been given a brief glimpse into the mind of the strange being they had discovered, or who had discovered them. To Alvin, the thoughts of Vanimond were as meaningless as 1,000 voices shouting together in some vast echoing cave. Yet the men of Lys could disentangle them, could record them to be analyzed at leisure. Already, so it was rumored, though Hilvar would neither deny nor confirm this, what they had discovered was so strange that it bore scarcely any resemblance to the history which all the human race had accepted for 1 billion years. Calitrax began to speak. To Alvin, as to everyone else in Diaspora, the clear, precise voice seemed to come from a point only a few inches away. Then, in a manner that was hard to define, just as the geometry of a dream defies logic yet rouses no surprise in the mind of the dreamer, Alvin was standing beside Calitrax, while at the same time he retained his position high up on the slope of the amphitheatre. The paradox did not puzzle him. He simply accepted it without question, like all the other masteries over time and space which science had given him. Very briefly, Calitrax ran through the accepted history of the race. He spoke of the unknown peoples of the dawn civilizations, who had left behind them nothing but a handful of great names and the fading legends of the Empire. Even at the beginning, so the story went, man had desired the stars, and had at last attained them. For millions of years, he had expanded across the galaxy, gathering system after system beneath his sway. Then, out of the darkness beyond the rim of the universe, the invaders had struck and wrenched from him all that he had won. The retreat to the solar system had been bitter and must have lasted many ages. Earth itself was barely saved by the fabulous battles that raged around Shalmarain. When all was over, man was left with only his memories and the world on which he had been born. Since then, all else had been long-drawn anticlimax. As an ultimate irony, the race that had hoped to rule the universe had abandoned most of its own tiny world and had split into the two isolated cultures of Lys and Diaspora, oases of life in a desert that sundered them as effectively as the gulfs between the stars. Calitrax paused. To Alvin, as to everyone in the great assembly, it seemed that the historian was looking directly at him, with eyes that had witnessed things which even now they could not wholly credit.
"So much," said Calitrax, "for the tales we have believed since our records began. I must tell you now that they are false, false in every detail. So false that even now we have not fully reconciled them with the truth."
He waited for the full meaning of his words to strike home. Then, speaking slowly and carefully, he gave to both Lys and Diaspora the knowledge that had been won from the mind of Vanimond. It was not even true that man had reached the stars. The whole of his little empire was bounded by the orbits of Pluto and Persephone, for interstellar space proved a barrier beyond his power to cross. His entire civilization was huddled around the sun, and was still very young when the stars reached him. The impact must have been shattering. Despite his failures, man had never doubted that one day he would conquer the depths of space. He believed, too, that if the universe held his equals, it did not hold his superiors. Now he knew that both beliefs were wrong, and that out among the stars were minds far greater than his own. For many centuries, first in the ships of other races and later in machines built with borrowed knowledge, man had explored the galaxy. Everywhere he found cultures he could understand but could not match, and here and there he encountered minds which would soon have passed altogether beyond his comprehension. The shock was tremendous, but it proved the making of the race. Sadder, and infinitely wiser, man had returned to the solar system to brood upon the knowledge he had gained. He would accept the challenge, and slowly he evolved a plan which gave hope for the future. Once the physical sciences had been man's greatest interest. Now he turned even more fiercely to genetics and the study of the mind. Whatever the cost, he would drive himself to the limits of his evolution. The great experiment had consumed the entire energies of the race for millions of years. All that striving, all that sacrifice and toil became only a handful of words in Kallitrax's narrative. It had brought man his greatest victories. He had banished disease. He could live forever if he wished. And in mastering telepathy, he had bent the most subtle of all powers to his will. He was ready to go out again, relying upon his own resources into the great spaces of the galaxy. He would meet as an equal the races of the worlds from which he had once turned aside, and he would play his full part in the story of the universe. These things he did. From this age, perhaps the most spacious of all history, came the legends of the Empire. It had been an empire of many races, but this had been forgotten in the drama, too tremendous for tragedy, in which it had come to its end. The Empire had lasted for at least a million years. It must have known many crises, perhaps even wars, but all these were lost in the sweep of great races moving together toward maturity.
"We can be proud," continued Kallitrax, "of the part our ancestors played in this story. Even when they had reached their cultural plateau, they lost none of their initiative. We deal now with conjecture rather than proved fact, but it seems certain that the experiments which were at once the Empire's downfall and its crowning glory were inspired and directed by man. The philosophy underlying these experiments appears to have been this. Contact with other species had shown man how profoundly a race's world picture depended upon its physical body and the sense organs with which it was equipped. It was argued that a true picture of the universe could be attained, if at all, only by a mind that was free from such physical limitations, a pure mentality, in fact. This was a conception common among many of Earth's ancient religious faiths, and it seems strange that an idea which had no rational origin should finally become one of the greatest goals of science. No disembodied intelligence had ever been encountered in the natural universe. The Empire set out to create one. We have forgotten, with so much else, the skills and knowledge that made this possible. The scientists of the Empire had mastered all the forces of nature, all the secrets of time and space. As our minds are the byproduct of an immensely intricate arrangement of brain cells, linked together by the network of the nervous system, so they strove to create a brain whose components were not material, but patterns embossed upon space itself. Such a brain, if one can call it that, would use electrical or yet higher forces for its operation, and would be completely free from the tyranny of matter. It could function with far greater speed than any organic intelligence. It could endure as long as there was an erg of free energy left in the universe, and no limit could be seen for its powers. Once created, it would develop potentialities which even its makers could not foresee. Largely as a result of the experience gained in his own regeneration, man suggested that the creation of such beings should be attempted. It was the greatest challenge ever thrown out to intelligence in the universe, and after centuries of debate it was accepted. All the races of the galaxy joined together in its fulfillment. More than a million years were to separate the dream from the reality. Civilizations were to rise and fall again and yet again. The age-long toil of worlds was to be lost, but the goal was never forgotten. One day we may know the full story of this, the greatest sustained effort in all history. Today, we only know that its ending was a disaster that almost wrecked the galaxy. Into this period, Vanimon's mind refuses to go. There is a narrow region of time which is blocked to him, but only, we believe, by his own fears. At its beginning, we can see the Empire at the summit of its glory, taut with the expectation of coming success. At its end, only a few thousand years later, the Empire is shattered, and the stars themselves are dimmed as though drained of their power. Over the galaxy hangs a pall of fear, a fear with which is linked the name, the Mad Mind. What must have happened in that short period is not hard to guess. The pure mentality had been created. but it was either insane or, as seems more likely from other sources, was implacably hostile to matter. For centuries it ravaged the universe until brought under control by forces at which we cannot guess. Whatever weapon the Empire used in its extremity squandered the resources of the stars. From the memories of that conflict spring some, though not all, of the legends of the invaders. But of this I shall presently say more. The mad mind could not be destroyed, for it was immortal. It was driven to the edge of the galaxy, and there imprisoned in a way we do not understand. Its prison was a strange, artificial star known as the Black Sun, and there it remains to this day. When the Black Sun dies, it will be free again. How far in the future that day lies, there is no way of telling. Calatrax became silent, as if lost in his own thoughts, utterly unconscious of the fact that the eyes of all the world were upon him. In the long silence, Alvin glanced over the packed multitude around him, seeking to read their minds as they faced this revelation, and this unknown threat, which must now replace the myth of the invaders. For the most part, the faces of his fellow citizens were frozen in disbelief. They were still struggling to reject their false past, and could not yet accept the yet stranger reality that had superseded it. Calatrax began to speak again in a quiet, more subdued voice as he described the last days of the Empire. This was the age, Alvin realized as the picture unfolded before him, in which he would have liked to have lived. There had been adventure then, and a superb and dauntless courage, the courage that could snatch victory from the teeth of disaster. Though the galaxy had been laid waste by the mad mind, the resources of the Empire were still enormous, and its spirit was unbroken. With a courage at which we can only marvel, the great experiment was resumed and a search made for the flaw that had caused the catastrophe. There were now, of course, many who opposed the work and predicted further disasters, but they were overruled. The project went ahead, and with the knowledge so bitterly gained, this time it succeeded. The new race that was born had a potential intellect that could not even be measured, but it was completely infantile. We do not know if this was expected by its creators, but it seems likely that they knew it to be inevitable. Millions of years would be needed before it reached maturity, and nothing could be done to hasten the process. Vanamond was the first of these minds. There must be others elsewhere in the galaxy, but we believe that only a very few were created, for Vanamond has never encountered any of his fellows. The creation of the pure mentalities was the greatest achievement of galactic civilization. In it, man played a major and perhaps a dominant part. I have made no reference to Earth itself, for its story is merely a tiny thread in an enormous tapestry. Since it had always been drained of its most adventurous spirits, our planet had inevitably become highly conservative, and in the end it opposed the scientists who created Vanamond. Certainly it played no part at all in the final act. The work of the Empire was now finished. The men of that age looked around at the stars they had ravaged in their desperate peril, and they made their decision. They would leave the universe to Vanamond. There is a mystery here, a mystery we may never solve, for Vanamond cannot help us. All we know is that the Empire made contact with something very strange and very great, far away around the curve of the cosmos, at the other extremity of space itself. What it was, we can only guess. But its call must have been of immense urgency and immense promise. Within a very short period of time, our ancestors and their fellow races have gone upon a journey which we cannot follow. Vanamond's thoughts seem to be bounded by the confines of the galaxy, but through his mind we have watched the beginnings of this great and mysterious adventure. Here is the image that we have reconstructed. Now you are going to look more than a billion years into the past. A pale wraith of its former glory,
The slowly turning wheel of the galaxy hung in nothingness. Throughout its length were the great empty rents which the mad mind had torn, wounds that in ages to come the drifting stars would fill. But they would never replace the splendor that had gone. Man was about to leave his universe, as long ago he had left his world. And not only man, but the thousand other races that had worked with him to make the empire. They were gathered together, here at the edge of the galaxy, with its whole thickness between them and the goal they would not reach for ages. They had assembled a fleet before which imagination quailed. Its flagships were suns, its smallest vessels planets. An entire globular cluster, with all its solar systems and all their teeming worlds, was about to be launched across infinity. The long line of fire smashed through the heart of the universe, leaping from star to star. In a moment of time, a thousand suns had died, feeding their energies to the monstrous shape that had torn along the axis of the galaxy and was now receding into the abyss.
So the Empire left our universe to meet its destiny elsewhere. When its heirs, the pure mentalities, have reached their full stature, it may return again, but that day must still lie far ahead. This, in its briefest and most superficial outlines, is the story of galactic civilization. Our own history, which to us seems so important, is no more than a belated and trivial epilogue, though one so complex that we have not been able to unravel all its details. It seems that many of the older, less adventurous races refused to leave their homes. Our direct ancestors were among them. Most of these races fell into decadence and are now extinct, though some may still survive. Our own world barely escaped the same fate. During the transition centuries, which actually lasted for millions of years, the knowledge of the past was lost or else deliberately destroyed. The latter, hard though it is to believe, seems more probable. For ages, man sank into a superstitious yet still scientific barbarism, during which he distorted history to remove his sense of impotence and failure. The legends of the invaders are completely false, although the desperate struggle against the mad mind undoubtedly contributed something to them. Nothing drove our ancestors back to Earth, except the sickness in their souls. When we made this discovery, one problem in particular puzzled us in Lys. The Battle of Shalmarain never occurred, yet Shalmarain existed and exists to this day. What is more, it was one of the greatest weapons of destruction ever built. It took us some time to resolve this puzzle, but the answer, once it was found, was very simple. Long ago, our Earth had a single giant satellite, the Moon. When, in the tug of war between the tides and gravity, the Moon at last began to fall, it became necessary to destroy it. Shalmarain was built for that purpose, and around its use were woven the legends you all know. Calatrax smiled a little ruefully at his immense audience. There are many such legends, partly true and partly false, and other paradoxes in our past, which have not yet been resolved. That problem, though, is one for the psychologist rather than the historian. Even the records of the central computer cannot be wholly trusted, and bear clear evidence of tampering in the very remote past. On Earth, only Diaspora and Lys survived the period of decadence. Diaspora, thanks to the perfection of its machines, Lys, owing to its partial isolation and the unusual intellectual powers of its people. But both cultures, even when they had struggled back to their former level, were distorted by the fears and myths they had inherited. These fears need haunt us no longer. It is not my duty as a historian to predict the future, only to observe and interpret the past. But its lesson is clear enough. We have lived too long out of contact with reality, and now the time has come to rebuild our lives.
Chapter 25. Jezerak walked in silent wonder through the streets of a diaspora he had never seen.
So different was it, indeed, from the city in which he had passed all his lives, that he would never have recognized it. Yet he knew that it was Diaspora, though how he knew, he did not pause to ask. The streets were narrow, the buildings lower, and the park was gone. Or rather, it did not yet exist. This was the Diaspora before the change, the Diaspora that had been open to the world and to the universe. The sky above the city was pale blue and flecked with raveled wisps of cloud, slowly twisting and turning in the winds that blew across the face of this younger earth. Passing through and beyond the clouds were more substantial voyages of the sky. Miles above the city, lacing the heavens with their silent tracery, the ships that linked Diaspora with the outer world came and went upon their business. Jezerak stared for a long time at the mystery and wonder of the open sky, and for a moment fear brushed against his soul. He felt naked and unprotected, conscious that this peaceful blue dome above his head was no more than the thinnest of shells, that beyond it lay space with all its mystery and menace. The fear was not strong enough to paralyze his will. In part of his mind, Jezerak knew that his whole experience was a dream, and a dream could not harm him. He would drift through it, savoring all that it brought to him, until he woke once more in the city that he knew. He was walking into the heart of Diaspora, toward the point where in his own age stood the tomb of Yarlan Zay. There was no tomb here in this ancient city, only a low circular building with many arched doorways leading into it. By one of those doorways, a man was waiting for him. Jezerak should have been overcome with astonishment, but nothing could surprise him now. Somehow it seemed right and natural that he should now be face to face with the man who had built Diaspora.
"You recognize me, I imagine," said Yarlan Zay.
"Of course. I have seen your statue 1,000 times. You are Yarlan Zay, and this is Diaspora as it was 1 billion years ago. I know I am dreaming and that neither of us is really here."
"Then you need not be alarmed at anything that happens. So follow me, and remember that nothing can harm you, since whenever you wish, you can wake up in Diaspora, in your own age."
Obediently, Jezerak followed Yarlan Zay into the building, his mind a receptive, uncritical sponge. Some memory, or echo of a memory, warned him of what was going to happen next, and he knew that once he would have shrunk from it in horror. Now, however, he felt no fear. Not only did he feel protected by the knowledge that this experience was not real, but the presence of Yarlan Zay seemed a talisman against any dangers that might confront him. There were few people drifting down the glideways that led into the depths of the building, and they had no other company when presently they stood in silence beside the long streamlined cylinder which, Jezerak knew, could carry him out of the city on a journey that would once have shattered his mind. When his guide pointed to the open door, he paused for no more than a moment on the threshold, and then was through.
"You see," said Yarlan Zay with a smile.
"Now relax, and remember that you are safe, that nothing can touch you."
Jezerak believed him. He felt only the faintest tremor of apprehension as the tunnel entrance slid silently toward him, and the machine in which he was traveling began to gain speed as it hurtled through the depths of the earth. Whatever fears he might have had were forgotten in his eagerness to talk with this almost mythical figure from the past.
"Does it not seem strange to you," began Yarlan Zay,
"that though the skies are open to us, we have tried to bury ourselves in the earth?
It is the beginning of the sickness whose ending you have seen in your age.
Humanity is trying to hide. It is frightened of what lies out there in space, and soon it will have closed all the doors that lead into the universe."
"But I saw spaceships in the sky above Diaspora," said Jezerak.
"You will not see them much longer. We have lost contact with the stars, and soon even the planets will be deserted. It took us millions of years to make the outward journey, but only centuries to come home again. And in a little while, we will have abandoned almost all of Earth itself."
"Why did you do it?" asked Jezerak.
He knew the answer, yet somehow felt impelled to ask the question.
We need it as shelter to protect us from two fears, fear of death and fear of space. We were a sick people and wanted no further part in the universe, so we pretended that it did not exist. We had seen chaos raging through the stars and yearned for peace and stability. Therefore, Diaspora had to be closed, so that nothing new could ever enter it. We designed the city that you know, and invented a false past to conceal our cowardice. Oh, we were not the first to do that, but we were the first to do it so thoroughly. And we redesigned the human spirit, robbing it of ambition and the fiercer passions, so that it would be contented with the world it now possessed. It took 1,000 years to build the city and all its machines. As each of us completed his task, his mind was washed clean of its memories, the carefully planned pattern of false ones was implanted, and his identity was stored in the city's circuits until the time came to call it forth again. So at last there came a day when there was not a single man alive in Diaspora. There was only the central computer, obeying the orders which we had fed into it, and controlling the memory banks in which we were sleeping. There was no one who had any contact with the past, and so at this point, history began. Then, one by one, in a predetermined sequence, we were called out of the memory circuits and given flesh again, like a machine that had just been built and was now set operating for the first time. Diaspora began to carry out the duties for which it had been designed. Yet some of us had had doubts even from the beginning. Eternity was a long time. We recognized the risks involved in leaving no outlet and trying to seal ourselves completely from the universe. We could not defy the wishes of our culture, so we worked in secret, making the modifications we thought necessary. The uniques were our invention. They would appear at long intervals and would, if circumstances allowed them, discover if there was anything beyond Diaspora that was worth the effort of contacting. We never imagined that it would take so long for one of them to succeed, nor did we imagine that his success would be so great. Despite that suspension of the critical faculties, which is the very essence of a dream, Jezerak wondered fleetingly how Jarl and Zay could speak with such knowledge of things that had happened 1 billion years after his time. It was very confusing. He did not know where in time or space he was. The journey was coming to an end. The walls of the tunnel no longer flashed past him at such breakneck speed. Jarl and Zay began to speak with an urgency and an authority which he had not shown before. The past is over. We did our work, for better or for ill, and that is finished with. When you were created, Jezerak, you were given that fear of the outer world, and that compulsion to stay within the city. That you share with everyone else in Diaspora. You know now that that fear was groundless, that it was artificially imposed on you. I, Jarl and Zay, who gave it to you, now release you from its bondage. Do you understand? With those last words, the voice of Jarl and Zay became louder and louder, until it seemed to reverberate through all of space. The subterranean carrier in which he was speeding blurred and trembled around Jezerak as if his dream was coming to an end. Yet as the vision faded, he could still hear that imperious voice thundering into his brain. You are no longer afraid, Jezerak! You are no longer afraid! He struggled up toward wakefulness, as a diver climbs from the ocean depths back to the surface of the sea. Jarl and Zay had vanished, but there was a strange interregnum when voices which he knew but could not recognize talked to him encouragingly, and he felt himself supported by friendly hands. Then, like a swift dawn, reality came flooding back. He opened his eyes and saw Alvin and Hilvar and Geraint standing anxiously beside him. But he paid no heed to them. His mind was too filled with the wonder that now lay spread before him, the panorama of forests and rivers, and the blue vault of the open sky. He was in Lys, and he was not afraid. No one disturbed him as the timeless moment imprinted itself forever on his mind. At last, when he had satisfied himself that this indeed was real, he turned to his companions. "Thank you, Geraint," he said. "I never believed you would succeed." The psychologist, looking very pleased with himself,
was making delicate adjustments to a small machine that hung in the air beside him.
"You gave us some anxious moments," he admitted. "Once or twice you started to ask questions that couldn't be answered logically, and I was afraid I would have to break the sequence.
Suppose Jarl and Zay had not convinced me, what would you have done then?"
"We would have kept you unconscious and taken you back to Diaspora, where you could have waked up naturally, without ever knowing that you'd been to Lys."
"And that image of Jarl and Zay you fed into my mind? How much of what he said was the truth?"
"Most of it, I believe. I was much more anxious that my little saga should be convincing rather than historically accurate. But Calatrax has examined it and can find no errors. It is certainly consistent with all that we know about Jarl and Zay and the origins of Diaspora."
"So now we can really open the city," said Alvin. "It may take a long time, but eventually we'll be able to neutralize this fear so that everyone who wishes can leave Diaspora."
"It will take a long time," replied Geraint dryly. "And don't forget that Lys is hardly large enough to hold several hundred million extra people, if all your people decide to come here." "I don't think that's likely, but it's possible."
"That problem will solve itself," answered Alvin. "Lys may be tiny, but the world is wide. Why should we let the desert keep it all?"
"So you are still dreaming, Alvin," said Jezerak with a smile. "I was wondering what there was left for you to do."
Alvin did not answer. That was a question which had become more and more insistent in his own mind during the past few weeks. He remained lost in thought, falling behind the others as they walked down the hill toward Airlie. Would the sentries that lay ahead of him be one long anticlimax? The answer lay in his own hands. He had discharged his destiny. Now, perhaps, he could begin to live. Chapter 26. There is a special sadness in achievement, in the knowledge that a long-desired goal has been attained at last, and that life must now be shaped toward new ends. Alvin knew that sadness as he wandered alone through the forests and fields of Lys. Not even Hilvar accompanied him, for there are times when a man must be apart even from his closest friends. He did not wander aimlessly, though he never knew which village would be his next port of call. He was seeking no particular place, but a mood, an influence, indeed a way of life. Diaspora had no need of him now. The ferments he had introduced into the city were working swiftly, and nothing he could do would accelerate or retard the changes that were happening there. This peaceful land would also change. Often he wondered if he had done wrong, in the ruthless drive to satisfy his own curiosity, by opening up the ancient way between the two cultures. Yet surely it was better that Lys should know the truth, that it also, like Diaspora, had been partly founded upon fears and falsehoods. Sometimes he wondered what shape the new society would take. He believed that Diaspora must escape from the prison of the memory banks and restore again the cycle of life and death. Hilvar, he knew, was sure that this could be done, though his proposals were too technical for Alvin to follow. Perhaps the time would come again when love in Diaspora was no longer completely barren. Was this, Alvin wondered, what he had always lacked in Diaspora? What he had really been seeking? He knew now that when power and ambition and curiosity were satisfied, there still were left the longings of the heart. No one had really lived until they had achieved that synthesis of love and desire which he had never dreamed existed until he came to Lys. He had walked upon the planet of the Seven Suns, the first man to do so in a billion years. Yet that meant little to him now. Sometimes he thought he would give all his achievements if he could hear the cry of a newborn child and know that it was his own. In Lys, he might one day find what he wanted. There was a warmth and understanding about its people which, he now realized, was lacking in Diaspora. But before he could rest, before he could find peace, there was one decision yet to be made. Into his hands had come power. That power he still possessed. It was a responsibility he had once sought and accepted with eagerness, but now he knew that he could have no peace while it was still his. Yet to throw it away would be the betrayal of a trust.
He was in a village of tiny canals, at the edge of a wide lake, when he made his decision. The coloured houses, which seemed to float at anchor upon the gentle waves, formed a scene of almost unreal beauty. There was life and warmth and comfort here, everything he had missed among the desolate grandeur of the Seven Suns. One day, humanity would once more be ready for space. What new chapter man would write among the stars, Alvin did not know. That would be no concern of his. His future lay here on Earth. But he would make one more flight before he turned his back upon the stars. When Alvin checked the upward rush of the ascending ship, the city was too distant to be recognized as the work of man, and the curve of the planet was already visible. Presently they could see the line of twilight, thousands of miles away on its unending march across the desert. Above and around were the stars, still brilliant for all the glory they had lost. Ilvar and Jezerak were silent, guessing but not knowing with certainty why Alvin was making this flight, and why he had asked them to come with him. Neither felt like speech, as the desolate panorama unfolded below them. Its emptiness oppressed them both, and Jezerak felt a sudden contemptuous anger for the men of the past who had let Earth's beauty die through their own neglect. He hoped that Alvin was right in dreaming that all this could be changed. The power and the knowledge still existed. It needed only the will to turn back the centuries and make the oceans roll again. The water was still there, deep down in the hidden places of the Earth. Or if necessary, transmutation plants could be built to make it. There was so much to do in the years that lay ahead. Jezerak knew that he stood between two ages. Around him, he could feel the pulse of mankind beginning to quicken again. There were great problems to be faced, but Diaspora would face them. The recharting of the past would take centuries, but when it was finished, man would have recovered almost all that he had lost. Yet could he regain it all? Jezerak wondered. It was hard to believe that the galaxy would be reconquered, and even if that were achieved, what purpose would it serve? Alvin broke into his reverie, and Jezerak turned from the screen. "I wanted you to see this," said Alvin quietly. "You may never have another chance."
"You're not leaving Earth."
"No. I want nothing more of space. Even if any other civilizations still survive in this galaxy, I doubt if they will be worth the effort of finding. There is so much to do here. I know now that this is my home, and I'm not going to leave it again." He looked down at the great deserts, but his eyes saw instead the waters that would be sweeping over them 1,000 years from now. Man had rediscovered his world, and he would make it beautiful while he remained upon it. And after that? "We aren't ready to go out to the stars, and it will be a long time before we can face their challenge again. I have been wondering what I should do with this ship. If it stays here on Earth, I shall always be tempted to use it, and will never have any peace of mind. Yet I cannot waste it. I feel that it has been given into my trust, and I must use it for the benefit of the world. So this is what I have decided to do. I'm going to send it out of the galaxy, with the robot in control, to discover what happened to our ancestors, and, if possible, what it was they left our universe to find. It must have been something wonderful for them to have abandoned so much to go in search of it. The robot will never tire, however long the journey takes. One day our cousins will receive my message, and they'll know that we are waiting for them here on Earth. They will return, and I hope that by then we will be worthy of them, however great they have become." Alvin fell silent, staring into a future he had shaped, but which he might never see. While man was rebuilding his world, this ship would be crossing the darkness between the galaxies, and in thousands of years to come it would return. Perhaps he would still be here to meet it, but if not, he was well content.
"I think you are wise," said Jezerak. Then for the last time the echo of an ancient fear rose up to plague him. "But suppose," he added, "the ship makes contact with something we do not wish to meet."
His voice faded away as he recognized the source of his anxiety, and he gave a wry, self-deprecatory smile that banished the last ghost of the invaders. "You forget," said Alvin, taking him more seriously than he expected, "that we will soon have Vanamond to help us. We don't know what powers he possesses, but everyone in Lys seems to think they are potentially unlimited. Isn't that so, Hilvar?" Hilvar did not reply at once. It was true that Vanamond was the other great enigma, the question mark that would always lie across the future of humanity while it remained on Earth. Already it seemed certain Vanamond's evolution toward self-consciousness had been accelerated by his contact with the philosophers of Lys. They had great hopes of future cooperation with the childlike supermind, believing that they could foreshorten the eons which his natural development would require.
"I am not sure," confessed Hilvar. "Somehow I don't think that we should expect too much from Vanamond. We can help him now, but we will be only a brief incident in his total lifespan. I don't think that his ultimate destiny has anything to do with ours."
Alvin looked at him in surprise. "Why do you feel that?" he asked.
"I can't explain it," said Hilvar. "It's just an intuition."
He could have added more, but he kept his silence. These matters were not capable of communication, and though Alvin would not laugh at his dream, he did not care to discuss it even with his friend. It was more than a dream, he was sure of that, and it would haunt him forever. Somehow, it had leaked into his mind during that indescribable and unshareable contact he had had with Vanamond. Did Vanamond himself know what his lonely destiny must be? One day, the energies of the Black Sun would fail, and it would release its prisoner. And then, at the end of the universe, as time itself was faltering to a stop, Vanamond and the Mad Mind must meet each other among the corpses of the stars. That conflict might ring down the curtain on creation itself. Yet it was a conflict that had nothing to do with man, and whose outcome he would never know.
"Look," said Alvin suddenly. "This is what I wanted to show you. Do you understand what it means?"
The ship was now above the pole, and the planet beneath them was a perfect hemisphere. Looking down upon the belt of twilight, Jezerak and Hilvar could see at one instant both sunrise and sunset on opposite sides of the world. The symbolism was so perfect and so striking that they were to remember this moment all their lives. In this universe, the night was falling. The shadows were lengthening toward an east that would not know another dawn. But elsewhere, the stars were still young, and the light of morning lingered. And along the path he once had followed, man would one day go again. The Sands of Mars. Introduction. In 2001, where have I seen that date before? It will be exactly half a century since this novel was published, or to put it in perhaps better perspective, it is already more than halfway back in time, dear reader, between you and the Wright brothers' first flight. Though I have not opened it for decades, I have a special fondness for Sands, as it was my first full-length novel. When I wrote it, we knew practically nothing about Mars, and what we did know was completely wrong. The mirage of Percival Lowell's canals was beginning to fade, though it would not vanish completely until our space probes began arriving in the late 1970s. It was still generally believed that Mars had a thin but useful atmosphere, and that vegetation flourished, at least in the equatorial regions where the temperature often rose above the freezing point. And where there was vegetation, of course, there might be more interesting forms of life, though nothing remotely human. Edgar Rice Burroughs' Martian Princesses had joined the canals in mythology. When I tapped out The End on my Remington Noiseless, portable, in 1951, I could never have imagined that exactly 20 years later I should be sitting on a panel with Ray Bradbury and Carl Sagan at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, waiting for the first news of the real Mars to arrive from the Mariner space probes. See Mars and the Mind of Man, Harper and Row, 1973. But that was only the first trickle of a flood of information. During the next two decades, the Vikings were to give stunning images of the gigantic Mariner Valley and
most awe-inspiring of all, Olympus Mons, an extinct volcano more than twice the height of Everest. Pause for embarrassed cough. Somewhere herein you'll find there are no mountains on Mars. Well, that's what even the best observers, straining their eyes to make sense of the tiny disk dancing in the field of their telescopes, believed in the 1950s. Soon after maps of the real Mars became available, I received a generous gift from computer genius John Hinckley, his VistaPro image processing system. This prompted me to do some desktop terraforming, a word, incidentally, invented by science fiction's grandest of grandmasters, Jack Williamson. I must confess that in The Snows of Olympus, A Garden on Mars, Norton, 1995, I frequently allowed artistic considerations to override scientific ones. Thus I couldn't resist putting a lake in the caldera of Mount Olympus, unlikely though it is that the most strenuous efforts of future colonists will produce an atmosphere dense enough to permit liquid water at such an altitude. My next encounter with Mars involved a most ambitious but, alas, unsuccessful space project, the Russian Mars 96 mission. Besides all its scientific equipment, the payload carried a CD-ROM disc full of sounds and images, including the whole of the famous Orson Welles War of the Worlds broadcast. I have a recording of the only encounter between HG and Orson made soon after this historic demonstration of the power of the new medium. Listening to the friendly banter between two of the great magicians of our age is like stepping into a time machine. It was intended that all these visions of Mars would, someday in the 21st century, serve as greetings to the pioneers of the next new world. I was privileged to send a video recording made in the garden of my Colombo home. Here is what I said. Message to Mars. My name is Arthur Clark, and I am speaking to you from the island of Sri Lanka, once known as Ceylon, in the Indian Ocean, planet Earth. It is early spring in the year 1993, but this message is intended for the future. I am addressing men and women, perhaps some of you already born, who will listen to these words when they are living on Mars. As we approach the new millennium, there is great interest in the planet that may be the first real home for mankind beyond the mother world. During my lifetime, I have been lucky enough to see our knowledge of Mars advance from almost complete ignorance, worse than that, misleading fantasy, to a real understanding of its geography and climate. Certainly we are still very ignorant in many areas and lack knowledge that you take for granted. But now we have accurate maps of your wonderful world and can imagine how it might be modified, terraformed, to make it nearer to the heart's desire. Perhaps you are already engaged upon that centuries-long process. There is a link between Mars and my present home, which I used in what will probably be my last novel, The Hammer of God. At the beginning of this century, an amateur astronomer named Percy Molesworth was living here in Ceylon. He spent much time observing Mars, and now there is a huge crater, 175 kilometers wide, named after him in your southern hemisphere. In my book, I've imagined how a new Martian astronomer might one day look back at his ancestral world to try and see the little island from which Molesworth and I often gazed up at your planet. There was a time soon after the first landing on the moon in 1969 when we were optimistic enough to imagine that we might have reached Mars by the 1990s. In another of my stories, I described a survivor of the first ill-fated expedition watching the Earth in transit across the face of the sun on May 11, 1984. Well, there was no one on Mars then to watch that event, but it will happen again on November 10, 2084. By that time, I hope that many eyes will be looking back towards the Earth as it slowly crosses the solar disk, looking like a tiny, perfectly circular sunspot. And I've suggested that we should signal to you then with powerful lasers, so that you will see a star beaming a message to you from the very face of the sun. I too salute you across the gulfs of space,
as I send my greetings and good wishes from the closing decade of the century in which mankind first became a spacefaring species, and set forth on a journey that can never end, so long as the universe endures. Alas, owing to a failure of the launch vehicle, Mars 96 ended up at the bottom of the Pacific. But I hope, and fully expect, that one day our descendants on the Red Planet will be chuckling over this CD-ROM, which is a delightful combination of science, art, and fantasy. It is still available from the Planetary Society, 65 North Catalina Avenue, Pasadena, California, 91106. On July 4, 1997, with a little help from the World Wide Web, Mars was news again. Pathfinder had made a bumpy landing on the Ares Vallis region and disgorged the tiny but sophisticated rover, Sojourner, whose cautious exploration of the surrounding rockscape was watched by millions on Earth. This was the moment when, for most people, Mars ceased to be a distant place in the sky and became a real world. Shortly afterwards, Donna Shirley, the engineer who had run the program, sent me her autobiography, Managing Martians, Broadway Books, 1998, with a dedication to Arthur Clarke, who inspired my summer vacation on Mars. Reading further, I was delighted to discover how this happened. At age 12 and searching for my own place in the world, I'd read The Sands of Mars, a book that pointed me towards the sky. Colombo, Sri Lanka, January 2001. Chapter 1.
So this is the first time you've been upstairs? Said the pilot, leaning back idly in his seat so that it rocked to and fro in the gimbals.
He clasped his hands behind his neck in a nonchalant manner that did nothing to reassure his passenger.
Yes, said Martin Gibson, never taking his eyes from the chronometer as it ticked away the seconds.
I thought so.
You never got it quite right in your stories, all that nonsense about fainting under the acceleration. Why must people write such stuff? It's bad for business.
I'm sorry, Gibson replied. But I think you must be referring to my earlier stories. Space travel hadn't got started then, and I had to use my imagination.
Maybe, said the pilot grudgingly.
He wasn't paying the slightest attention to the instruments, and takeoff was only 2 minutes away.
It must be funny, I suppose, for this to be happening to you after writing about it so often.
The adjective, thought Gibson, was hardly the one he would have used himself, but he saw the other's point of view. Dozens of his heroes, and villains, had gazed hypnotized by remorseless second hands, waiting for the rockets to hurl them into infinity. And now, as it always did if one waited long enough, the reality had caught up with the fiction. The same moment lay only 90 seconds in his own future. Yes, it was funny. A beautiful case of poetic justice. The pilot glanced at him, reading his feelings, and grinned cheerfully.
Don't let your own stories scare you. Why, I once took off standing up, just for a bet, though it was a damn silly thing to do.
I'm not scared, Gibson replied with unnecessary emphasis.
Said
the pilot, condescending to glance at the clock. The second hand had one more circuit to go.
Then I shouldn't hold on to the seat like that. It's only beryl manganese, you might bend it.
Sheepishly, Gibson relaxed. He knew that he was building up synthetic responses to the situation, but they seemed nonetheless real for all that.
Of course, said the pilot, still at ease, but now, Gibson noticed, keeping his eyes fixed on the instrument panel. It wouldn't be very comfortable if it lasted more than a few minutes. Ah, there go the fuel pumps. Don't worry when the vertical starts doing funny things, but let the seat swing where it likes. Shut your eyes, if that helps at all. Hear the igniter jets start, then. We take about 10 seconds to build up to full thrust. There's really nothing to it, apart from the noise. You just have to put up with that. I said you just have to put up with that.
But Martin Gibson was doing nothing of the sort. He had already slipped gracefully into unconsciousness,
at an acceleration that had not yet exceeded that of a high-speed elevator. He revived a few minutes and 1,000 kilometers later, feeling quite ashamed of himself. Footnote. The metric system is used throughout this account of space travel. This decimal system is based upon the meter equaling 39.37 inches. Thus, a kilometer would be slightly over 1/2 mile, 0.62 miles. End footnote. A beam of sunlight was shining full on his face, and he realized that the protective shutter on the outer hull must have slid aside. Although brilliant, the light was not as intolerably fierce as he would have expected. Then he saw that only a fraction of the full intensity was filtering through the deeply tinted glass. He looked at the pilot, hunched over his instrument board and busily writing up the log. Everything was very quiet, but from time to time there would come curiously muffled reports, almost miniature explosions, that Gibson found disconcerting. He coughed gently to announce his return to consciousness and asked the pilot what they were.
"Thermal contraction in the motors," he replied briefly. "They've been running round 5,000 degrees and cool mighty fast. You feeling all right now?"
"I'm fine," Gibson answered and meant it.
"Shall I get up?"
Psychologically, he had hit the bottom and bounced back. It was a very unstable position, though he did not realize it.
"If you like," said the pilot doubtfully. "But be careful. Hang on to something solid."
Gibson felt a wonderful sense of exhilaration. The moment he had waited for all his life had come. He was in space. It was too bad that he'd missed the takeoff, but he'd glossed that part over when he wrote it up. From 1,000 kilometers away, Earth was still very large, and something of a disappointment. The reason was quickly obvious. He had seen so many hundreds of rocket photographs and films that the surprise had been spoilt. He knew exactly what to expect. There were the inevitable moving bands of cloud on their slow march round the world. At the center of the disk, the divisions between land and sea were sharply defined, and an infinite amount of minute detail was visible. But towards the horizon, everything was lost in the thickening haze. Even in the cone of clear vision vertically beneath him, most of the features were unrecognizable, and therefore meaningless. No doubt a meteorologist would have gone into transports of delight at the animated weather map displayed below. But most of the meteorologists were up in the space stations anyway, where they had an even better view. Gibson soon grew tired of searching for cities and other works of man. It was chastening to think that all the thousands of years of human civilization had produced no appreciable change in the panorama below. Then Gibson began to look for the stars, and met his second disappointment. They were there, hundreds of them, but pale and wan, mere ghosts of the blinding myriads he had expected to find. The dark glass of the port was to blame. In subduing the sun, it had robbed the stars of all their glory. Gibson felt a vague annoyance. Only one thing had turned out quite as expected. The sensation of floating in mid-air, of being able to propel oneself from wall to wall at the touch of a finger, was just as delightful as he had hoped, though the quarters were too cramped for any ambitious experiments. Weightlessness was an enchanting, a fairy-like state, now that there were drugs to immobilize the balance organs, and space sickness was a thing of the past. He was glad of that. How his heroes had suffered! His heroines, too, presumably, but one never mentioned that. He remembered Robin Blake's first flight in the original version of Martian Dust. When he'd written that, he had been heavily under the influence of D.H. Lawrence. It would be interesting one day to make a list of the authors who hadn't influenced him at one time or another. There was no doubt that Lawrence was magnificent at describing physical sensations, and quite deliberately, Gibson had set out to defeat him on his own ground. He had devoted a whole chapter to space sickness, describing every symptom, from the queasy premonitions that could sometimes be willed aside, the subterranean upheavals that even the most optimistic could no longer ignore, the volcanic cataclysms of the final stages, and the ultimate, merciful exhaustion.
The chapter had been a masterpiece of stark realism. It was too bad that his publishers, with an eye on a squeamish Book of the Month club, had insisted on removing it. He had put a lot of work into that chapter. While he was writing it, he had really lived those sensations. Even now.
"It's very puzzling," said the M.O. thoughtfully as the now quiescent author was propelled through the airlock. "He's passed his medical tests okay, and of course he'll have had the usual injections before leaving Earth. It must be psychosomatic."
"I don't care what it is," complained the pilot bitterly as he followed the cortege into the heart of Space Station 1. "All I want to know is who's going to clean up my ship?"
No one seemed inclined to answer this heartfelt question, least of all Martin Gibson, who was only vaguely conscious of white walls drifting by his field of vision. Then, slowly, there was a sensation of increasing weight, and a warm, caressing glow began to steal through his limbs. Presently, he became fully aware of his surroundings. He was in a hospital ward, and a battery of infrared lamps was bathing him with a glorious, enervating warmth that sank through his flesh to the very bones.
"Well," said the medical officer presently.
Gibson grinned feebly.
"I'm sorry about this. Is it going to happen again?" "I don't know how it happened the first time. It's very unusual. The drugs we have now are supposed to be infallible."
"I think it was my own fault," said Gibson apologetically. "You see, I've got a rather powerful imagination, and I started thinking about the symptoms of space sickness, in quite an objective sort of way, of course, but before I knew what had happened..."
"Well, just stop it," ordered the doctor sharply, "or we'll have to send you right back to Earth. You can't do this sort of thing if you're going to Mars. There wouldn't be much left of you after 3 months."
A shudder passed through Gibson's tortured frame, but he was rapidly recovering, and already the nightmare of the last hour was fading into the past.
"I'll be okay," he said. "Let me out of this muffle furnace before I cook."
A little unsteadily, he got to his feet. It seemed strange, here in space, to have normal weight again. Then he remembered that Station 1 was spinning on its axis, and the living quarters were built around the outer walls, so that centrifugal force could give the illusion of gravity. The great adventure, he thought ruefully, hadn't started at all well, but he was determined not to be sent home in disgrace. It was not merely a question of his own pride. The effect on his public and his reputation would be deplorable. He winced as he visualized the headlines.
"Gibson grounded. Space sickness routs author astronaut."
Even the staid literary weeklies would pull his leg, and as for time... No, it was unthinkable.
"It's lucky," said the M.O., "that we've got 12 hours before the ship leaves. I'll take you into the zero-gravity section and see how you manage there, before I give you a clean bill of health."
Gibson also thought that was a good idea. He had always regarded himself as fairly fit, and until now it had never seriously occurred to him that this journey might be not merely uncomfortable, but actually dangerous. You could laugh at space sickness when you'd never experienced it yourself. Afterwards, it seemed a very different matter. The inner station, Space Station 1, as it was usually called, was just over 2,000 kilometers from Earth, circling the planet every 2 hours. It had been man's first stepping stone to the stars, and though it was no longer technically necessary for spaceflight, its presence had a profound effect on the economics of interplanetary travel. All journeys to the moon or the planets started from here. The unwieldy atomic ships floated alongside this outpost of Earth, while the cargoes from the parent world were loaded into their holds. A ferry service of chemically fueled rockets linked the station to the planet beneath, for by law, no atomic drive unit was allowed to operate within 1,000 kilometers of the Earth's surface. Even this safety margin was felt by many to be inadequate, for the radioactive blast of a nuclear propulsion unit could cover that distance in less than a minute. Space Station 1 had grown with the passing years by a process of accretion, until its original designers would never have recognized it. Around the central spherical core had accumulated observatories,
communications labs with fantastic aerial systems, and mazes of scientific equipment which only a specialist could identify. But despite all these additions, the main function of the artificial moon was still that of refueling the little ships with which man was challenging the immense loneliness of the solar system.
"Quite sure you're feeling okay now?" asked the doctor as Gibson experimented with his feet.
"I think so," he replied, unwilling to commit himself.
"Then come along to the reception room, and we'll get you a drink. A nice hot drink,"
he added to prevent any misunderstanding.
"You can sit there and read the paper for half an hour before we decide what to do with you."
It seemed to Gibson that anticlimax was being piled on anticlimax. He was 2,000 kilometers from Earth, with the stars all around him. Yet here he was, forced to sit, sipping sweet tea. Tea! In what might have been an ordinary dentist's waiting room. There were no windows, presumably because the sight of the rapidly revolving heavens might have undone the good work of the medical staff. The only way of passing the time was to skim through piles of magazines which he'd already seen, and which were difficult to handle as they were ultra-lightweight editions, apparently printed on cigarette paper. Fortunately, he found a very old copy of Argosy containing a story he had written so long ago that he had completely forgotten the ending, and this kept him happy until the doctor returned.
"Your pulse seems normal," said the M.O. grudgingly.
"We'll take you along to the zero-gravity chamber. Just follow me, and don't be surprised at anything that happens." With this cryptic remark, he led Gibson out into a wide, brightly lit corridor that seemed to curve upwards in both directions, away from the point at which he was standing. Gibson had no time to examine this phenomenon, for the doctor slid open a side door and started up a flight of metal stairs. Gibson followed automatically for a few paces, then realized just what lay ahead of him and stopped with an involuntary cry of amazement. Immediately beneath his feet, the slope of the stairway was a reasonable 45 degrees. But it rapidly became steeper, until only a dozen meters ahead, the steps were rising vertically. Thereafter, and it was a sight that might have unnerved anyone coming across it for the first time, the increase of gradient continued remorselessly, until the steps began to overhang, and at last passed out of sight above and behind him. Hearing his exclamation, the doctor looked back and gave a reassuring laugh.
"You mustn't always believe your eyes," he said. "Come along and see how easy it is."
Reluctantly, Gibson followed, and as he did so, he became aware that two very peculiar things were happening. In the first place, he was gradually becoming lighter. In the second, despite the obvious steepening of the stairway, the slope beneath his feet remained at a constant 45 degrees. The vertical direction itself, in fact, was slowly tilting as he moved forward, so that despite its increasing curvature, the gradient of the stairway never altered. It did not take Gibson long to arrive at the explanation. All the apparent gravity was due to the centrifugal force produced as the station spun slowly on its axis. And as he approached the center, the force was diminishing to zero. The stairway itself was winding in towards the axis along some sort of spiral. Once he'd have known its mathematical name, so that despite the radial gravity field, the slope underfoot remained constant. It was the sort of thing that people who lived in space stations must get accustomed to quickly enough. Presumably, when they returned to Earth, the sight of a normal stairway would be equally unsettling. At the end of the stairs, there was no longer any real sense of up or down. They were in a long cylindrical room, crisscrossed with ropes, but otherwise empty. And at its far end, a shaft of sunlight came blasting through an observation port. As Gibson watched, the beam moved steadily across the metal walls like a questing searchlight, was momentarily eclipsed, then blazed out again from another window. It was the first indication Gibson's senses had given him of the fact that the station was really spinning on its axis, and he timed the rotation roughly by noting how long the sunlight took to return to its original position. The day of this little artificial world was less than 10 seconds. That was sufficient to give a sensation of normal gravity at its outer walls. Gibson felt rather like a spider in its web as he followed the doctor hand over hand along the guide ropes, towing himself effortlessly through the air until they came to the observation post. They were, he saw, at the end of a sort of chimney jutting out along the axis of the station, so that they were well clear of its equipment and apparatus, and had an almost unrestricted view of the stars.
"I'll leave you here for a while," said the doctor. "There's plenty to look at, and you should be quite happy. If not, well, remember there's normal gravity at the bottom of those stairs."
Yes, thought Gibson. And a return trip to Earth by the next rocket as well. But he was determined to pass the test and to get a clean bill of health. It was quite impossible to realize that the space station itself was rotating and not the framework of sun and stars. To believe otherwise required an act of faith, a conscious effort of will. The stars were moving so quickly that only the brighter ones were clearly visible, and the sun, when Gibson allowed himself to glance at it out of the corner of his eye, was a golden comet that crossed the sky every 5 seconds. With this fantastic speeding up of the natural order of events, it was easy to see how ancient man had refused to believe that his own solid Earth was rotating, and had attributed all movement to the turning celestial sphere. Partly occulted by the bulk of the station, the Earth was a great crescent, spanning half the sky. It was slowly waxing as the station raced along on its globe-encircling orbit. In some 40 minutes it would be full, and an hour after that would be totally invisible. A black shield eclipsing the sun while the station passed through its cone of shadow. The Earth would go through all its phases, from new to full and back again, in just 2 hours. The sense of time became distorted as one thought of these things. The familiar divisions of day and night, of months and seasons, had no meaning here. About 1 kilometer from the station, moving with it in its orbit, but not at the moment connected to it in any way, were the 3 spaceships that happened to be in dock at the moment. One was the tiny arrowhead of the rocket that had brought him, at such expense and such discomfort, up from Earth an hour ago. The second was a lunar-bound freighter of, he guessed, about 1,000 tons gross. And the third, of course, was the Ares, almost dazzling in the splendour of her new aluminum paint. Gibson had never become reconciled to the loss of the sleek, streamlined spaceships, which had been the dream of the early 20th century. The glittering dumbbell hanging against the stars was not his idea of a space liner. Though the world had accepted it, he had not. Of course, he knew the familiar arguments. There was no need for streamlining in a ship that never entered an atmosphere, and therefore the design was dictated purely by structural and power plant considerations. Since the violently radioactive drive unit had to be as far away from the crew quarters as possible, the double sphere and long connecting tube was the simplest solution. It was also, Gibson thought, the ugliest. But that hardly mattered, since the Ares would spend practically all her life in deep space, where the only spectators were the stars. Presumably she was already fueled, and merely waiting for the precisely calculated moment when her motors would burst into life, and she would pull away out of the orbit in which she was circling, and had hitherto spent all her existence, to swing into the long hyperbola that led to Mars. When that happened, he would be aboard, launched at last upon the adventure he had never really believed would come to him. Chapter 2. The captain's office aboard the Ares was not designed to hold more than 3 men when gravity was acting, but there was plenty of room for 6 while the ship was in a free orbit, and one could stand on walls or ceiling according to taste. All except one of the group clustered at surrealist angles around Captain Norden had been in space before and knew what was expected of them. But this was no ordinary briefing. The maiden flight of a new spaceship is always an occasion, and the Ares was the first of her line, the first, indeed, of all spaceships ever to be built primarily for passengers and not for freight. When she was fully commissioned, she would carry a crew of 30 and 150 passengers in somewhat Spartan comfort. On her first voyage, however, the proportions were almost reversed, and at the moment her crew of 6 was waiting for the single passenger to come aboard.
"I'm still not quite clear,"
said Owen Bradley, the electronics officer. What were you supposed to do with the fellow when we've got him? Whose bright idea was this, anyway?
I was coming to that, said Captain Norden, running his hands over where his magnificent blonde hair had been only a few days before.
Spaceships seldom carry professional barbers, and though there are always plenty of eager amateurs, one prefers to put off the evil day as long as possible.
You all know of Mr. Gibson, of course.
This remark produced a chorus of replies, not all of them respectful.